All right, I just want to take a quick peek and remind you, I did this last year, but I want to remind you of Job chapter 1, and it'll just be quick, and then we'll jump into our 25. So grab your copy of God's Word and Job 1. And the reason I've selected Job, here's what's kind of cool. All my closest friends are dead. Just all my buddies. So Job's kind of like a buddy, but he's been dead for quite a long time. He stinketh. So Job is the first book, as you know, just to give you a reference point, Job is the first book written in the Bible. You know, Genesis wasn't the first book written. Job was. So he's the oldest model of leadership I can offer up to you as young men. And I think it's even good to go back into ancient leadership and see how all of these 25 transfer on a guy who didn't own a Bible. So Job is the first book written, so he didn't have a Bible. He didn't have the law. And so he had some weaknesses in what he did compared to what you have accessible to you as you sit down and have a copy of God's Word in your lap. He wouldn't have that. And so I bring Job, Benaiah on the courage side, Job on the character side, okay? And that'll be the end of our foundational material, and then we'll move into our 25 and work the next 4 hours of those 25. Job is an example, in my estimation, simple estimation, and again, I'm a simple guy from Bangor, Maine, who got saved, and God chooses to work through at times, and I'm extremely grateful. Job epitomizes, he encapsulates, I think, all 25. And so he's, if there's a classic example or a comprehensive example, Job would be the guy. So I'll read, there's kind of three sections in this first chapter. I'll read the three and make comments, but we're going to move rather quickly. We won't do a heavy exposition on it, but because it's after lunch. But I want to draw your attention to it. And then I want you to go back in your small groups and study it, underline it, highlight it. And then I want you to try to find the 25 in Job by way of homework or further study, okay? Fair? So basically, we have to come to grips with our ordinariness. We've got 25 non-negotiable, bare minimum hills to die on as young men. You have to get these down. And we have Benaiah is kind of our hero in the orbit of courage. And then Job's our hero in the orbit of character. Let's read the first five verses. I'm going to make some comments. And I am going to cause you to fall in love with Job. He is, in my estimation, a true rock star. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And the man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. Seven sons and three daughters were born to him. His possessions also were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. And that man was the greatest of all the men of the East. His sons, your age, used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, probably birthday. And they would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of feasting had completed their cycle, Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. And Job said, "Perhaps the reason I do this, my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did this continually. It was the pattern of his life as a dutiful father to care for his sons' souls. First things you notice in this text, verse 1, is his character. He's a massive man of character. He's an actual guy, because some people say that. They'll challenge you, say, Job, he wasn't really a real guy. But it's clear he was real. There was a man in the land of Uz, so it's giving you a pointer to geography. But even James says, have you considered Job or the endurance of Job? So even the New Testament writers verify and validate that he was an actual guy, all right? And his name was Job. And then look at the descriptors about Job. He is blameless, So he tries to keep short sin accounts. He's upright. In other words, he walks a straight line. He fears God, which is going to be our number one trait that you're going to have. Notice he fears God and he turns away from evil. So when evil approaches him, he vacates. He flees evil. These are four descriptors of his life. Now you're thinking, okay, Job wrote the book of Job, so he wrote himself into the story and he kind of painted himself in a good light. You know, he kind of, you know, made himself look the best. Well, check out God's description of him. It's the same. Verse 8. The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there's no one like him on earth, a blameless and an upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." So now that's God's commentary. The Spirit of God writing through Job evokes God's opinion on Job's life, and it matches verse 1. But here's the kicker. Look at 2:8. Or 2:9. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity?" So his wife says he's a man of integrity. Now, you know that it's possible, even in the context of your own home, it's possible to have hypocrisy, where you say one thing on Sunday, but on Monday, things aren't quite the same. You know, everybody dolls up and dresses up on Sunday, and then Monday, it's kind of back to normal, and you can kind of see, wow, that's not, it's some inconsistency, you know? And nobody knows you like your mom. Nobody knows me like my wife. I mean, if there's going to be discrepancies in my character, it will be manifest in the context of my home because I close the doors, nobody's around. And when nobody's around, how you act, that's your true character. So a lot of us will put on character when we're in public to save face or to not be embarrassed, right, as leaders? The whole goal of Scripture is to match your, you know, your life with your lips. And that makes you a man of integrity. Your integrity is when nobody's around, how do you act? That's the true you. And so Job says he's a man of God. God says he's a man of God. Now his wife is in concert saying, hey, this guy's a man of God. And so I think it's important just to note from the outset of chapter 1 that this is a man of character. And what he's about to accomplish in his life is a result of him taking serious his relationship to God. As a young man, you need to pay close attention to your character. Everything will be built on the shoulders of character. If you lack character, you'll be a house of cards. Now, you can keep piling it on, but eventually that house of cards will actually come crumbling down. And so, under the influence of the Spirit of God, it's very clear that what Job's about to experience is not because he's doing anything wrong, because he's about to have the worst day of his life. And I would say the worst day of any guy's life. So you're looking at a worst case scenario from here on out in this text. You're looking at a guy who's going to have a very messy day. Notice also in this passage, chapter 1 happens in a single day. This isn't over a period of time. It's one dramatic day. And the way that he responds to this one crazy day is evidence of his character. Because in a crisis or in difficulty or in the midst of suffering, character for a leader is revealed. It's not made. It's too late when you're in the crisis. It's just revealed. It's not made. And so you can learn from your mistakes in a crisis, but how you respond kind of tells you where you're at spiritually in reference to your character. And so it's very clear Job is going to have a nightmare day, but it's not because of anything he has done wrong. As a matter of fact, he's doing everything right. Next, just to give you a reference point, it talks about his sons and his daughters. And in agrarian culture, guess what? You guys are more valuable than daughters. That's the way it was. Sons were more valuable. And so the text is just reminding us that this is a hardy man. This is a wealthy man. He's got seven sons and, yeah, three daughters. Because sons could work the fields. Daughters didn't. And so it behooved you to have a lot of sons
so that he could carry on the family business. And then in verse 3, you tell how old the story is because it measures wealth by his livestock count. You notice that? I mean, it talks about, 7,000 sheep. Well, what does that translate? That's wool. So he had a clothing business, okay? So he had a massive clothing business. He made these wool tunics, Brooks Brother tunics. Then it says he had 3,000 camels. What do you use camels for? Transportation. So he had a killer transportation business, right? 500 yoke of oxen. What would you use 500 yoke of oxen for? Work the fields, right? You got to plant. You got to harvest. Now, 500 female donkeys. Who wants a donkey? Matter of fact, the other day I was driving down to the lake, and I went by and I saw a house, a farm, and there's just a bunch of donkeys. I'm thinking, what do you do with donkeys? Like, honestly, like, you don't really ride them. I guess you can. Yeah, carry them, but this is Kentucky. It's like flat. You know what I'm saying? Like, carrying what? You know, we have SUVs. You know what I'm saying? Like, why would you get a donkey? You got to feed the thing every day. Anyway, what mattered then was 500 female donkeys. Warm donkey milk was a delicacy at this time. It was like going to Starbucks. So basically, this is Starbucks 4,000 years ago. So these are warm lattes. And so it just speaks to the fact that this guy has a breadth, a wide empire. For his time and his day, he's killing it. That's what it's saying. So what you get, the picture you get when you leave these verses is his character's in line, his business is in line, his family's in line. So he's kind of banging on all four cylinders. He's at the top of his game. That's what you get. And then you see what kind of father he is. So he's got these kids. They gather on either their birthday or anniversary when they get married, maybe their spiritual birthday. And they gather and they party. And so he's so concerned that when they party, that they cross over the line and sin. So he gets up the next morning after all the feasting's taken place and all the revelry and all the killer parties take place. He gets up before they ever get up because they're crashed and sleeping in like a high school student growing. And they're just sleeping at 11 o'clock and being sluggards. He's up early in the morning and he's praying. He's saying, God, please, if they'd done something stupid, if my boy's done something stupid, forgive them. You know, I'll take it for them. I stand as an advocate. And so he's doing advocacy as a father for his kids. This is a tremendous, tremendous example. It's what you'll be doing when you have children one day. You'll do what I do with my 10-year-old and my 4-year-old. I go in their bed when they're sleeping, and I lay hands on them, and I say, God, make them into strong, fiery arrows against the evil one. I pray for them to be missionaries and pastors. I pray for them to make a difference. They're like sacked out. You know, bugs are dropping in their mouth. They're gone, you know, and I pray over them. I do it all the time. You'll do that too as a dad one day, because that's what dutiful dads do. They're concerned that their prodigy, their sons, would grow up and be strong in the Lord. So this is the picture here. So when you read those first five verses, you're thinking, I mean, Job's, he's killing it. I mean, you'd look at Job and think, man, if I want my dad to be like that, or better yet for you guys, I should be like that. I should pay close attention to my character. I should look over others and care about others more than myself, i.e. his kids. And I should make a difference in the world and work hard. Hey, three great commendable attributes of a leader. So the opening five verses begin on earth, and you get a little picture into Job's life. Then the story twists. It pivots. Look at verse 6 through 12. We leave earth and we go to heaven. What I'm about to read is an opportunity like no other. You're getting to see into the Holy of Holies and a conversation between God and Satan himself. Check it out. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came in among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there's no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a sweet little hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? You bless the work of his hands and his possessions and have increased in the land. But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. Then the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not put forth your hand on him physically. So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord. Now, one thing you have to note here in the text. Job doesn't know what's going on. He's unsuspecting. It's a beautiful day in Uz. Life is just moving on. It's smooth sailing. You're getting to read back into the account. As a reader, you're looking at the situation from a different vantage point. Job is unsuspecting. He doesn't know what's about to happen. And so Satan goes before the Lord, and the Lord asks Satan a question. Where did you come from? Now, you should think, as a young man, you be a serious thinker here. You should know one of the attributes of God is that he's what? All-knowing, right? He's omniscient. Why is God asking Satan where has he been? Is he doing it for God's benefit? No. Who's he doing it for? Our benefit. That text, verse 7, ought to creep you out. It ought to creep you out because you realize now that God's asking Satan a question so that he will answer the question, and you will fully understand that you are being hunted as young men. You are prey. Look what it says. From where do you come? Satan says, I've been roaming about the earth and walking around on it. Will you take verse 7 and couple it with 1 Peter 5:8? He goes around like a what? Roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Now you got a full picture. That's not for God's benefit in verse 7. That's for our benefit. Gentlemen, in high school, 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade, 12th grade, whatever grade you're in, you have to know this. You are being hunted. You are prey for Satan. He would love nothing more than to take down your life. As God has a wonderful plan for your life, so does Satan. And all those doors that seem to get open for you in high school may not be opened by the Lord. That gal that comes by and says she likes you, you think, look at me. Look at what I've got. Look at the prize, not knowing and unsuspecting. That's Satan's little gift for you to distract you from doing what you're really called to do in this life. So verse 7 is just an insight into the reality that as a young man, you're being hunted. And then the Lord said to Satan, listen, Job's not offering himself up as an example. God offers Job up. I mean, think about that. Could God say that about your life? Have you considered my servant Dan? Have you considered my servant Joe? Have you considered my servant Mike? Have you considered my servant Mark? I mean, what a commentary in your life when God would say, hey, you ought to put one of my servants to the test because I'm telling you the kid is faithful and true, even in high school. He's not going to run. He's going to fight and he's going to stand there. He's going to jump in a pit on a snowy day and kill a lion. This is God saying, hey, Satan, have you considered my servant Job? And then what does Satan do? Here's the cosmic battle. Satan says, yeah, I get it. He's serving you because look at verses 1 to 5. He owns like 30 Starbucks. He's got a Brooks Brothers whole company. I mean, a truck line. Look at that. He's having to feed 10,000 mouths a day. He's got food, cash. Why wouldn't he follow you? So the accusation is this. Hey, God, I understand his character's intact, but it's only intact because you're blessing his socks off. He's got, Game Boy, Xbox, boats, toys, killer dad. I mean, he's got everything. So why wouldn't he? Why wouldn't he be compliant? Why wouldn't he follow you? I mean, you've given him all the toys of life. And so he's following you, what? For the goodies, not necessarily for the gospel. That's the accusation. And so God says, okay, I'll take you up on your offer. You can do anything you want to him except for you can't lay a finger on his physical body. You can't physically touch him. Now, that's going to come in chapter 2. That's going to be your homework to check out chapter 2. So, yes, that's in chapter 2. Stay focused. It's the sandwich. You just got a sandwich. That was too much chocolate, maybe. At the table, the center thing. You don't want to eat that stuff. Okay, so we're on earth. We go to heaven. Guess what? Back to earth, verse 13. Now look at this, because this is the punchline. This is the big exclamation. Now in the day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in his own older brother's house, so there's a party going on, a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys were feeding beside them, and these Sabaean terrorists attacked and took them. They also slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Oh my goodness. I mean, Job gets a knock at his door. He comes out of his Bedouin home there, and he gets this message that the oxen have been taken and the donkeys. So there goes his ability to feed and all of his Starbucks. And then he kills all the servants. And he's probably thinking, man, that's like, you know, a quarter of my entire empire gone. Look at verse 16. While he was still speaking, so he's wrapping up the conversation of this bearer of bad news who showed up at his house. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. And I alone have escaped to tell you. So if you get into the insurance business one day, this is what we call an act of God. It's lightning. Satan controls the elements. He controls the lightning here. He fires down with accuracy and precision, and he takes out all of the sheep and all of the people working. So there goes his clothing industry. All right. His Dolce & Gabbana is gone. Gone in a single storm. I mean, you talk about, that's a lot of sheep with precision. That's precision lightning. That's the power of Satan. Now, Satan submits to God. You know, you don't want to overestimate his power, but listen to me, you don't want to underestimate his power. He's controlling elements here. You don't think he can bring some gal in high school to you to throw you off your game? Trust me, he has the capacity. He's, with lightning precision, nailing all those sheep. Like plinking them like Plinko. I mean, this is like a video game. This is cakewalk for him, okay? So he's like, man, that's a lot. I mean, this is intense. Check it out, verse 17. While he was still speaking. So that guy's kind of wrapping up his story, saying, hey, Mr. Job, I'm so sad this happened. It's a bummer. I'm grieved for you. I get it. This is a guy standing behind him, waiting to talk to him. He's like, good gravy. Another one. And while he's still speaking, another also came and said, the Chaldeans formed three bands, and they made a raid on those camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Well, there's the last of the business enterprise, right? All gone. All gone. This is insane. Now, if you're Job and you've been a titan and you've been kind of a rock star businessman, you're probably thinking, I could rebuild. But it's going to be hard to get employees, right? Because every time a piece of the business was consumed, so were all the employees. Listen, the word on the street is you probably don't want to work for the guy. It's lethal. Okay, if you get a job with him, it might cost you your life. So this is serious. But Job's a man of God, right? And he understands physical versus metaphysical. He understands physical versus spiritual. And he did probably muster within himself, because he's a leader. He probably said to himself, you know what? I can rebuild. And it's true. You see people who lose wealth and they just have the capacity. They kind of have that entrepreneurial spirit, and they come at it from a different angle, and they just seem to get back on their feet, and they get back on their feet rather quickly. And it's just, so I can see him kind of digging deep, you know, in his heart and saying, okay, we're going to rebuild, sitting his wife down and say, hey, don't worry, you know, don't go buy any new shoes, you know, but can't go to D3 this year, we can't afford it, but we're going to rebuild. That's probably what's going on there at 17. But look at verse 18. You talk about the uppercut. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And behold, a great wind came from across the wilderness. It struck the four corners of the house. It fell on the young people, and they all died. And I alone have escaped to tell you. A great wind? Yeah, it makes sense of where he lived, because you had the mountains and the desert meeting across from Midian there where Job would have lived. And what happens? How do you get tornadoes? When warm air hits cold air, right? And you get this movement. And so it's tornadic winds. Tornadic winds designed by Satan with precision to hit his kid's house where they're all partying. Hits the four corners of the house. House collapses. Kills all the kids. Now it's a different ball game. He's lost his entire business. Now his wife is standing before him, and they're looking over 10 fresh graves. 7 boys dead, 3 daughters. Standing over 7 graves. Satan, back up, is watching this. He's causing this. You look at Satan, and he's thinking, man, I've got him right where I want him. He is going to crumble. He is going to fall like a house of cards. He doesn't have any game. He's jumping in no pit on a snowy day to kill a lion. He has been crushed. I've crushed the old boy. He doesn't have a prayer. Check out the next verse, because this is the punchline of Job 1. Then Job arose. Why would he have to get up? Where was he? He's on his face, guys. This is a man who's lost 7 boys and 3 daughters and his entire empire. He's literally prostrate on the ground. He's crushed. He's distraught. He rose up. He tore his robe. Remember, they wore those sweet dresses. He tore that thing because that was a sign of contrition, you know. So he tears this robe in contrition, and then he shaves his head. How he got composure after all this bad news to put a straight blade. Remember, they didn't have Gillette, you know, the vibrating 3-blade things. You guys don't shave yet. Some of you do. But you know what I mean? Those, they didn't have the nice blades. I mean, this is like, it's polished metal. That's the best it would get. Some kind of alloy, some kind of metal, and polished down to be like a razor blade. He has enough composure to get to his head and do that. After hearing this news, I'm thinking, that's insane. He shaves his head, and Satan's like literally sitting on the edge of his seat going, oh, I got him. You know, he's picking his teeth, smoking a cigarette, Marlboro Light, just going, ah, I got him. You know, just picture the scene, right? And then look what the text says. He fell to the ground, and gentlemen, you need to never forget that. He fell to the ground, not in anger towards God, not putting a question mark to God. He fell to the ground and worshiped. Because that's what true spiritual leadership does in the context of the crisis. Right? God takes ordinary man, puts his spirit in them, gives them the capacity to do extraordinary things. And before you is a classic example of how a man could be thrashed by Satan. He had done nothing wrong, only everything right. And he falls down and he worships. And that's the big question for you. Because life right now may have been a challenge. It may not have been a challenge at your young age. But the challenges are coming. You live, guys, look up. You live in a broken world. It's messy. People die. People get hurt. You will die. Right? And that's just the reality. It is a messy, messy world. It's a Genesis 3 world. It's broken and fallen. The question is when the crisis comes, not if, but when it comes to you as a young man, how will you respond? Will you walk away from God, or will you say, I worship, I continue on? Because God is good and he has my best interest in mind. He's sovereign. He knows this. This didn't take God by surprise. It took Job by surprise, but it didn't take God by surprise, right? But it continues. Look at verse 21. Can you say these words as a high school student? He said, naked I came from my mother's womb. Naked I'll return there. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Look, notice verse 22, almost like a parenthetical statement, almost the fine print that you never read on packaging, right? Look at it. Through all of this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. I'm going to tell you something, guys. It's not if you go through the crisis, it's when. And the question will be, when you fall down and you are torn and brutalized by life's harsh circumstances, will you worship or will you run? True spiritual leadership always jumps in the pit, right, on a snowy day and kills a lion. That's what we do. That's how you respond. This is the only option for gospel leadership. The average man, one of these things, just one of them happened. They lose their Starbucks, would crush a family, cause marital conflict, kick you out of private school. You have to go to public school and bus all the way across town. Lo and behold, poor you. Come on. One of these things would crush us. You talk about a collective, comprehensive day. This didn't happen over a week or over a lifetime. This is a single day is what you're reading. Single day. And how are you going to respond? How are you going to react to that? This is Job. The only proper response is for you to worship and not run. I don't care how hard life gets. If you're going to be a gospel leader, you've got to have some stick-to-ity. You've got to have some tenacity. You've got to have some giddy up and go, some gumption. Right? You have to have some serious and sober moments and respond like this. And through all of this, he didn't sin. So I think Benaiah gives you a clear picture of courageous gospel leadership. Job epitomizes it. And the reason Job can respond in worship in verse 20 is because of verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. His character was intact, and so when the crisis came, he did what was instinctive to him. And we're going to talk about this. Having disciplines in your life so that it's second nature. When I was in the military, that's all we did is train all day. We'd fly all day. I'd jump out of helicopters all day. I'd jump in every harsh circumstances. We'd look for high waves, land on back of ships, jump out. Train. Why? So that when the day came where someone needed to be rescued, it was routine. It was what I did. I didn't think twice about jumping out of a helicopter at night in high seas when the water's on fire because JP-5's been lit in a plane crash. I didn't think twice about it because that's what I did. We had on our Navy patches, on our flight suits, and on our dive gear, it said, "So others may live." That was our motto in the Navy in 1986 when I got saved. That transferred over into gospel work. I still have the motto, "So other people may live." And when I talk about live, it's about eternity, not just the physical life now. And so you've got to train over and over and work and have this character intact in your life so that when the crisis comes, you respond like in verse 20. Okay? Job is commended to you. I want you to read chapter 2. If you're going to be in our cohort this week, you got to do a little bit of reading at night. So go to bed and just read chapter 2 and think, well, at least he had his physical body. You know, he had his guns. He had thunder and lightning, you know. So he had thunder and lightning, right? Oh, no. As Hershey boy said, you know, he's about to get the boils. I mean, he's about to get physical, right? So just read on. That's part of your homework. All right. Let's get into our first of 25. You're looking tired, so stay with me. It's hotter than blazes in here. I'm losing weight. I'm about to fly away. I'll text him. But it's all training for this afternoon because it's like 180 degrees outside. So hold on. Don't get excited. I just put this. The girls are dying of heat. Good. Boom. We're not scared of heat. You know why? Because we would.
The one
We are going to what? Jump in a pit on a snowy day and kill a lion. Woo! Right. All right. Turn me to Proverbs 1. Let's look at our first one. We've got some work to do. I'll go another 10 and stop. How's that? We'll do one and stop. Give you a break. Go get your chance. I want you to be fully in tune for these war games. Okay? No headbutting. Don't, and no killing any other kids, please. We don't want you to do this literally. This is kind of metaphor. Okay, maybe headbutting. Maybe headbutting. Proverbs 1. Don't panic. Go to the front if you can't find it. I can't find it. I'm just kidding. All right, Proverbs 1. So this is the first of 25. These are hills to die on. You have to know this as a high school student. You must, number one, fear God. Look at Proverbs 1:7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Only fools despise wisdom and instruction. Period. Now listen to me. Proverbs 1 to Proverbs 9:18 is written for you. It's not written for girls. It's not intended for girls. 27 times from Proverbs 1 to Proverbs 9 verse 18 it says, "My son." This is Solomon sitting down with his son on the back porch of his Bedouin tent and telling him, "Listen to me, there's some things you need to know as a young man." There are 15 different discourses in here. The baseline, though, the foundation to his instruction to his son is the necessity that you have a healthy fear of God. Every single one of those words matter. Healthy fear of God. Just to remind you, to show you, look at chapter 2, verse 1. Look what he says. My son. 3:1. My son, do not forget my teaching, but let you keep, but your heart keep my commandments. These are 15 discourses that only you as young men can apply. It talks about lust and the voluptuous woman of chapter 5. It tells you what she's going to be like. She looks good on the outside, but she literally has steps leading you down to hell. I mean, it talks about all that stuff. It's like a stiff cup of coffee at midnight to a drunk man. This is sobering stuff. 15 different discourses for you guys. So you ought to know this material. If you don't have a dad, you lean into Proverbs 1 to 9. Because at 9:18, the Proverbs of Solomon start. And they're good. They're pithy, tight, black and white. They punch you. They beat you up. They pin you in the corner. They smack you around a little bit. That's the Proverbs of Solomon. But Proverbs 1 to 9 are 15 separate discourses that you need to own. Okay? So there's my 25. You want 2.0 of this lecture series? Then you go to Proverbs 1 to 9. And you say, "Dad, would you help me walk through all this and work with me?" So check it out. This is what he says. And I'll just do the first couple right off the bat. Number one, he says, son, you need to fear God. Number two, you need to honor your parents. Number three, you need to choose your friends wisely. Check it out. 1:7, fear of the Lord is beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom. Look at verse 8. Hey, hear my son, your father's instruction, and don't forsake your mother's teaching. Indeed, they are a graceful wreath to your head and an ornament about your neck. They garnish your life. They hem in and make your life unique. Check it out, though. Look what he says, verse 10. Remember what I said? Fear God, honor mom and dad, choose your friends wisely. Look at it, verse 10. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent to them. In other words, your buddies come and say, "Hey, let's sneak out tonight. Let's sneak out tonight. I got some marijuana." You don't know how to say it. You're so young. He says this, if they say, "Come with us, let us lie in wait for blood or ambush the innocent without cause." These kids are up to no good. They're troublesome. So he says, you better choose your friends wisely. And we'll have a whole section on that later. I'm just showing you the context so that you will appreciate, because sometimes you cats get up this summer and you go, "I know I'm supposed to read my Bible. Where should I read?" Hint, Proverbs 1 to 9 is for you. I mean, the girls can't even apply it. It's awesome. When the Bible, not only is the Bible all of it for you, but then you get special privilege. You know, this is written and targeted you as the audience. This is how you live grisly. Now, check it out. Who wrote it? Solomon. Hey, he didn't have the cleanest of life. I mean, he was messy, right? And he started out good, messy middle, and then finishes strong. Well, that's kind of like your life. You're going to start out good as a kid. You're going to have a messy middle, and you're going to end up finishing strong, because that's how leaders do. It's not how you start. It's how you finish. The Christian life isn't a sprint. It's a marathon. You don't have to go to Boston to run a marathon. It's right here in the text of Scripture. It's right before your eyes. Okay? This is where the gut check is. So, let's go back to our original point. Fear God. What does it mean to fear God? Listen, at the heart of every future gospel leader is a robust and high view of God. You live out, listen to me, you live out your view of God. If you have a high view of God, you're going to have a high standard of living. If you have a low view of God, you're going to have a low view of living. Let me say it differently. Big God, little problems. You've got a little God, you've got big problems here at camp at D3. You have to have a high view of God. You have to have a healthy fear of God. Not a fear that immobilizes you and causes you to cringe. That's not the gospel. But one that puts zip into you, that gives you a little zest and a little zeal, so that when you see something and someone doing something wrong, you step into it. You don't kind of turn the other cheek and say, well, I don't know, that kid's just a little weird. You go right at it. You say, dude, that's wrong. You don't treat gals like that. You don't act like that. You don't say that, right? That's having a healthy fear of God. Remember Job? What did it say? He was blameless and a man who what? Feared God, right? It means you have a high view of God. How do you cultivate a high view of God as a young man? You need to study some theology. Theology is a big word. It just means the attributes of God. You need to understand how awesome and how amazing God is. Can I just give you a sampling of that? Turn to Psalm 139, and we'll just look at a couple of verses. And this will flat scare the bejeebies out of you. Psalm 139, hang a left. My favorite Psalms. So how do you cultivate a healthy fear of God? So I'm telling you, you have to have a fear of God as a young man. But how do you get it there? Look what it says. Oh, Lord, you've searched me. Look at we're just going to look at verse all the way down to verse 11. Here we go. Oh, Lord, you've searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You understand my thought from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down. You are intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there's a word on my tongue, you know it all. You've enclosed me behind and before, and you laid your hand upon me. Your knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's too high. I can't even attain to it. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in hell, you're there. If I take the wings of the dawn and I fly as far east or west, you're there. If I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, you're there. And your hand will lead me, and your right hand will lay hold of me. If I say, okay, surely the darkness will overwhelm me and the light around me will be like light. No, even the darkness is not dark to you. And the light, it's as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to you. Guys, two attributes of God, just samples here. There's four in the text. Two, his omniscience and his omnipresence. God knows everything. And God is everywhere. Those first 11, 12 verses are the single greatest aid to my sanctification. It's how I grow. You know why? Because every time I have to sin, I have to step over the knowledge of God and the presence of God to do so. So you can lock yourself in your room. You can, and I hope you don't have your computer in your room. But if you do, you can lock yourself in your room. You can have your computer in your room and nobody be around. You can put a blanket over your bunk bed. You want to make it feel like you're in a fort, you know, like a pit. I get it. But you can do all that stuff. But let me tell you something. And you can sin on your computer, or you can not sin. You can do whatever it is. You can sin in your mind. Let me tell you something. You live out your life before an audience of one, and that's God. So you can hide things from Uncle Dan, but you're not going to hide things from the Lord. You have to know of His omniscience, that He knows everything you do and everything you think, and He's everywhere. What does that mean? You don't have any privacy. You can put the little sign on your door, man cave, keep out, I'll crush your head, to your younger brother. I get it. You don't have any privacy. And that's the whole point. And the knowledge, it is mind-boggling. He says, when I get up and when I rise up and when I go to bed, in the casual acts of getting up and sitting down, you know, when you came in this morning and you sat down in the chair just about an hour ago, He knew it. Of every single one of us, of every single person that's lived, and everybody that lives on the earth right now, He knows every single movement. That is some vast knowledge. And He does it effortlessly. It doesn't take Him any energy at all to monitor and keep tabs on you. You have no privacy. That's why when David writes out his theology of how much God knows about him, look what he says in verse 6. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's too high. I cannot attain to it. You know how you translate that? That blows my mind. That's what David's saying. So what do you want to do when your mind is blown and your cover's blown? What do you want to do? Run, right? You don't want any part of that, because that's some serious scrutiny. If you think your parents are all up in your grill, wait till you see what God can do, right? So what do you want to do? Look at David. Now, keep in mind, between verses 6 and 7, guess what David's thinking about? What did David do? One night he went out on the balcony, right? Looked out and saw a finest frog hair girl. And he went and committed adultery. So David knows that God knows what he did. Nobody else might have known, but God knew. So between verses 6 and 7, he's wanting to run. Look what he says. Where can I get away from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? And he runs through a number of hypothetical situations. They're not true, but they're just to show you how comprehensive God's presence is. He said, if I go to heaven, or I make my bed in hell, or if I go 7 fathoms down the ocean, or if I go as far east and west on the wings of a bird, I do all that. I it doesn't matter. You're there. And then he says, okay, so I get kryptonite. I get in a closet with, you know, window, dark shades over the windows and no light coming in. I put a blanket over me. I'm in a box and I'm hidden. Nobody can see me. No. Camouflage hides man from man or man from animal. Not God. Not God. Guys, you have to know how big and awesome God is. If you're going to be an effective leader, you have to appreciate His omniscience and His omnipresence. That informs a fear of God. And so that you go, wow, I'm not tinkering with another buddy in school. This is not another man to rival with. This is God Almighty. This is why we have camps like this, so that you will come away and go, I came face to face with Jesus Christ. And man, it is awesome. And this is why we're so serious and we're energetic and compassionate about it, because we understand who God is. I've been at this for 27 years now. I know who God is. You know, I've sensed His presence. And I'm telling you, before I sin, I have to, like massive speed bumps, jump over these first 12 verses. I have to jump over the knowledge of God and listen, the presence of God. Listen to this statement. Secret sin on earth is open scandal in heaven. Secret sin on earth is open scandal in heaven. God knows what you're doing. You can hide it from your mom, your dad, your buddies, girlfriend, whatever you're hiding, and whatever you're hiding here at D3, you can hide it, but please understand, you're not hiding it from God. I just want you to know that. That's what I mean by having a fear of God. Don't fear me. Don't fear Kurt. Don't fear Eric. Don't fear the leaders. Fear God. That's who we want you to know. And God puts in your path people, other leaders, to strike a chord in your heart, to get in your face and to talk to you, not so that you'll obey us. That's not the end game. The end game is, as a young man in high school, you have a healthy fear of God. You understand the gospel. You commit your life to Jesus Christ. You ask forgiveness for your sins. And you wrangle with the Lordship of Christ in your heart. Okay? That's what it means to have a healthy and robust fear of God. What does that look like? Obedience. What did Jesus say? If you love me, what do? You do the right thing. That's what leaders do. If you love me, you keep my commandments. When someone asks me to do something I don't want to do, it's not a burden to me. Because commands aren't burdensome. When you're about giving yourself away and caring about others and being gospel-centric, it's no big deal. So when you are fussing and fighting about cleaning your room, you are being a bean dip. I mean, you are just being silly. That lacks any high view of God. Any high view of God. Why? Let's say it together to close. Because real leaders jump in a pit on a snowy day and kill a lion. You're done.